that at all. You were a movie star, remember?
Hello, and welcome to episode 36 of Popcorn and Prosecco, a show that's all about talking about movies. And I am Perry Nemiroff, and here are my co-hosts, Christy Pachko and Angie Han.
Hey, everybody.
Hi.
This time around, we are talking about Fury, the LA Film Prize, and Birdman, and we're going to kick off the show by talking about Fury, and Angie's going to take that one.
Okay, so Fury is the latest movie by David Ayer, and it stars Brad Pitt, Logan Lerman, Shia LaBeouf, John Bernthal, and Michael Pena. They're Christy's giving me a thumbs up because I managed to get them all right. And they're five men who are in a Sherman tank called the Fury toward the end of World War II in Germany. And the war is almost at an end, but they're sent on, you know, one kind of late mission to go deep into enemy territory, and then it's a war movie, so there's a war going on, so then horrible things happen.
A war. It's World War II.
Right. No big deal, just World War II. it's a very simple premise. That's it, really. And if you want to get a little bit more into it, Brad Pitt is the leader of this group of people, and Logan Lerman is like the newbie that up until now he was like a typist in the army or something, but they needed more people, so they sent him and were just like, here, replace the guy that died. And one of his first tasks, which is so sad, is literally like scraping up the remains of the guy that died in the tank. Like they assign him to clean
his
it
face.
Out, and he like picks up half of a person's face. And then
that was the point where I was like, oh, we're doing this.
Oh, that was the point in the movie where you were like, oh,
and
we're
that
doing
was
this?
The point I was like, yeah, it's gore.
This is a movie that starts with gore. Like this, like, you know, desolate battlefield, and the tank is in there, and then a white horse of symbolism comes by. Brad Pitt like jumps out and like stabs the guy riding it to death. So immediately, this is a movie that's like, we're gonna be gritty and real and tough, and you know, war is hell. And it's not a bad movie really, but my problem with it is that it never really progresses beyond that. It's very gritty. I feel like on a technical level, it's very well done. The acting is pretty good. You know, Logan Lerman, I was especially surprised by, because he's someone that I've seen in a few things, and he hasn't made that strong of an impression on me.
I think it's because it's not really about anything.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, at the end of the movie, I was like, what was the point? I mean, it's telling me, you know, war is hell, and in war, you know, even good men do bad things, and you know,
but
men
then
in
the
World War II were heroes, and I was like, well, I already kind of knew all that, like, I didn't need it. It's fine, it's very gritty, it's very realistic, you know, they put a lot of care into it, but it's just...
It's very well shot and well acted. They actually have no real goal at the end, except for, like, that last little mission. I mean, it's very clear what they are trying to do and how they need to go about doing it, but... You know, none of the characters really change. Some of them are assholes. Nobody gets any better. You're kind of just left with what they experience. It's a war story slice of life, which isn't particularly satisfying.
Yeah, especially because there's only really one emotional arc in the film, and that's Logan Lerman's character. Because everybody else is kind of, like, deeply bitter about the war already, and so they're more just pulling factors on him being like, this is what war is. And, like, Logan Lerman's the only arc to follow, and... I actually think he's pretty good in this. I also want to point out, I was surprised Shia LaBeouf's pretty good in this.
Really? I thought he was okay, but the thing about Shia LaBeouf and Michael Pena and John Bernthal is, they have very little to do.
No, like, yeah, they're stereotypes.
They're also, like, wartime cliches. Like, there's the leader, there's the little baby, there's the angry one.
And then, I was like, I said that to somebody, I was like, wait, but who is Michael Pena? And they're like, he's the Mexican. And I was like, oh, yeah, because that is what they keep saying about him. Like, they're like, you know, he'll speak Spanish. They're like, we're in Germany. You don't speak Spanish in Germany. Which also, Brad Pitt is basically...
You don't speak Mexican in Germany.
Mexican in Germany, you're right. They say you don't speak Mexican in Germany. But, like, yeah, that's kind of, like, his defining characteristic, which is kind of lame because Michael Pena was amazing in David Ayer's last movie, and so it feels like this is all he gets to do in this. But, like, it's just frustrating.
You can see the three supporting actors, and they're very much supporting actors, despite what the poster has you believe that it's an ensemble.
It's not an ensemble.
It's really not. And the three supporting actors, you can see that they put a lot of effort into it. You can see that kind of, like, in their heads, they have their character has this whole story. Like, they put a lot of care into it. But the story just doesn't give them anything to do. They have one note to play the entire movie.
There is no story. I mean, they're kind of just moving forward based on whatever their orders are. Like, they're not motivating anything, really, until the very end. It's like the whole movie is about how it ends, and that's not going to work, really.
No, and, like, I was disappointed because there's, like, a scene in the middle, which I guess I don't really want to get into super much because of...
You want to get into it.
I do.
We can talk about it a little bit. Are you talking about the scene with the two women?
Yeah.
There's a scene in the middle where the action kind of grinds to a halt because they go and take over this little German town, and then Brad Pitt and Logan Lerman go up into investigate an apartment where they, like, notice that there's someone in there from looking into the window from outside. And in there are these two women, and then they have this weird interaction with them. I don't know. I don't want to get too spoilery.
The problem with it is that they force their way in, and then it's supposed to be this scene of, like, how they found civility. Like, they found love in a hopeless place. But I don't buy it because they're invaders. Like, the way these women are behaving is completely compromised by the fact that they don't know who these dudes are, they don't speak their language, and, like, they came in with guns and are like, this is what we want to do. And now it's not as violent as that scenario could have gotten.
Do they actually pull their guns on them, though?
No, but he does take the gun into the bedroom with her. He doesn't, like, leave it behind. So the threat's still there. As they say on It's Always Sunny, the implication.
So that with that part, I mean, it's that was, like, a really weird part of the movie where, like,
it's a long part. They're, like, in there for, like, 20 minutes.
I understood what they were trying to do, but the problem is that those two characters are treated more like props than, like, actual characters. And, you know, to be fair, that's kind of the same problem I had with the three supporting male characters, as we discussed. But that's exactly why this movie feels so hollow, and like, despite all the effort that went into this movie, and despite how technically good it is, it just doesn't feel like there's anything there, really. I feel like if you like war movies and you're the kind of person that's, like, a World War II nerd, then this is probably going to be your jam, because it, you know, they put so much care into the details, it's very well acted, you know, it looks really good. And it's the inside of a Sherman tank. Like, how often do you see that? But
it should have been about Logan Lerman and Brad Pitt's relationship. Like, that, yeah, with that scene in the middle, that's kind of half the fun of it, is that the engaging quality of it is trying to figure out what they're going to do and how they're going to react and how they're going to treat these people. And that's kind of the same is true throughout the entire movie. Like, one of my favorite parts was when he was put in the tank for the first time and they roll up on the enemy and, like, they just try to get him to kill people, and he screws it up big time. I loved the interactions there and, like, how rough Brad Pitt was with him, and I wanted to know what he was going to do after, if he was going to, like, run and cry or man up and start fighting.
That was
a lot of fun to track, but it's not the main thing in the movie at all.
Yeah, I mean, you wanted more whiplash in this war movie.
Yeah.
Is that right?
No, that's actually pretty accurate.
I like that scene, too, and I feel like that's what it is. Like, at first with the movie, I was like, oh, okay, I think they're actually trying to do something interesting with this. It felt a lot like End of Watch, which is, like, another movie that looks at a very familiar, familiar type of character, and then kind of, like, delves into who these people are and what their lives are like.
That one actually did.
Yeah,
and this one know those characters.
This one starts out seeming like it's going to go that way, and then it just gives you nothing. I think somewhere in the middle of the movie, it starts to turn into, like, very cliched World War II type film. The other thing I want to bring up in this movie is, so this movie takes place over about 24 hours, right?
I think it's more than that.
I think it's just
a couple of days, because he arrives on one day. They do the attack on the other day, they're with the women another day, and then the big finale is another day. It's got to be like 4 or 5 days.
I thought it was all the same day, but whether it's one day or whether it's 4 or 5 days, the other thing is that Logan Lerman's transformation happens incredibly fast.
Yeah.
His relationship with Brad Pitt goes from 0 to 60 really fast. It all just feels kind of artificially heightened. It's like that scene where they're invading the women's home. It just kind of feels like the movie is pushing them this way because it has to go that way, rather than something that feels natural and organic and makes sense for the character.
I think that's a good point.
What it comes down to is that Fury's an action movie. Like, period. That's what this is. Like,
there's not that many action scenes,
really,
though.
There's some big tank battles.
There's some big
tank battles. But, like, in the middle of it, like I said, you have this, like, huge scene that I think could have worked if they had established the two characters more. But, like, I don't know, man. There's, like, that huge sequence at the end
That sequence goes on for like a solid 30 minutes. There's a sequence right before that, which is like one of the slowest action sequences I've ever seen in my life, but still so riveting at the same time. I really enjoyed that.
You know, I guess you're right. It's an
action. The two scenes at the beginning, really the only part that there's not action is the scene with the women right smack in the middle and some of the negotiations with Jason Isaacs' character.
Yeah.
Right. I guess that's right. I guess it's just because there are scenes that are so slow in this that I was like, is it an action movie? But you're right, it's an action movie.
Because I walked away not having taken much from the movie, but at the same time, I was thoroughly entertained, and I think that's because there were so much explosions and fighting and yelling and gore, and I
have to see
fine throughout this whole movie.
The action scenes are really well done. They were very distressing to me. There was one part, I forget what happened, but something actually threw me back in my seat where I was just like, oh, like the violence in this is next level intense. And I think if you're a really big fan of war movies, then you're not really going to care that the characters aren't very well developed because they are stereotypes. So if you already have attachment to those archetypes, you're going to be fine watching this movie. I personally would have liked to have known these characters more because they just eventually become kind of white noise of like, like Angie said, like, war is hell. And
they even have the Brad Pitt character. I wish I had written it down, but he spouts cliches about, you know, ideals are neat and history is messy or something like that.
Yeah, he says ideals are beautiful or something, but history is violent.
Right, and it's like a big, deep thing, and it's just like, oh, okay, we've heard that before, that's fine.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Right, just, so what are we saying about this one? Is it worth seeing or is it not? I would recommend it to people who are okay with gore to this level and violence in this respect. I mean, I was thoroughly entertained from beginning to end. I really wasn't that put off by the middle scene, although I do really hear where Christy is coming from with that one. I didn't leave having taken anything. I wasn't thinking about this movie after it was over, but you know, it was a little over 2 hours, and I was never bored. I was entertained.
I was bored. I don't know. I don't think I would recommend this unless you're someone who really loves war movies and are just like, I won't miss a war movie, or unless you're someone who loves Inglourious Basterds so much that you're willing to watch Brad Pitt, like, kind of repeat himself.
I can't think about him.
Where this movie starts with him jumping on a Nazi and stabbing him in the face, which is how that movie ends.
Mm-hmm.
I'd skip it. I feel like it's a lot of promising stuff that just doesn't pay off. I feel like you can catch up with it when it comes out on VOD and not really miss too much.
I'm in between. I wasn't bored, but I wasn't really engaged either. Like, when bad things happen to the characters, you should care more than I cared when I was watching it. So I would say, you know, if you like war movies a lot, and or if you're a World War II nerd and you're so excited that something got all like gritty and realistic and got the details right, then yeah, absolutely watch this movie. If you're someone that could kind of take or leave that genre, then take or leave this movie. I mean, if you watch it, it's fine. If you don't watch it, you don't need to go out of your way.
All right, so that's it for Fury. We are on to our next topic of the show, the LA Film Prize, and that one goes to Christy.
Yeah, so I was away last weekend. I couldn't film with the girls because I was at the Louisiana Film Prize, which takes place in Shreveport. I was going to say Indiana because what? It takes place in Shreveport, Louisiana. And it's this really amazing short film festival where if you get in, they automatically give you $500. You can use that however you like. A lot of people use it on post-production or on like advertising their film. That's where I got these rad snap bracelets from. It's like, they're amazing.
Show us the snap bracelet in action.
Ready? Ready? Look at this bad boy. Whoop. Bam! I thought that was a really cool thing. It was actually for a short film that's a parody of 80s action movies, so the slap bracelet was, it was all very kind of clever and funny. But yeah, there's several different prizes they give out. There's a Best Actress and Actress Award, where that person gets $1,000 for winning. There's Founder Circles Grant, which is chosen by the judges, of which I was one. And that gives you $3,000 towards making your next film. There's the top five prizes. They get distribution through Shorts HD, which means eventually their short will be on iTunes. But before that, it's going to go to a bunch of other short film festivals. And some of those festivals could make it eligible for Oscar nomination. So that's pretty huge. But then the grand prize winner, which is decided 50% by the audience and 50% by the judges, is a $50,000 cash prize.
That's a pretty significant amount of prizes right there.
Yeah, and I've never heard of a prize that big for a short film. And, like, they're all under 15 minutes. And what's cool is, to enter it, you have to have shot your film in Shreveport. You don't need to be a local filmmaker, but Shreveport's actually really close to Arkansas and Texas. This is sign language for that. but
if you're only listening to this episode, no, it's not. Christy's just making weird
configurations of language. So anyway, but yeah, it was cool because we met people who are from that area, but also people who had traveled there to shoot, and all the shorts are under 15 minutes, shot locally. And what's cool is Shreveport has all these incredible backdrops. Like, me and the other judges were kind of wandering around and just looking at this place, and it's amazing. And also, there's an infrastructure there of people who do work there. Millennium Studios has the thing there, which, like, they could be in touch with you if you need help with them, potentially. Like, it was really incredible. And then, on top of that, it's not just a festival about film. They brought in local food vendors, and they brought in, like, local musicians. So there was also, like, a music prize aspect, and there was all this incredible food. And it created this whole culture and this whole environment of excitement and created a village in a way that a lot of festivals, I think, fail to do. So it was really fun from the perspective of someone visiting the festival, but then also offered these filmmakers this really great community of people who were excited to see what they had to do. And on top of that, the shorts were incredible. Like, I don't know what the budgets are. I would actually really be interested. If any of you guys are listening and want to tell me what your budget is, I'll keep it quiet, but I would like to know. But there were some amazing things. Like, it's astounding what was accomplished in 15 minutes and within the specifics. There was a science fiction film about a couple who is separated because one of them is going to Mars on a mission and never will return, and it was really moving, and I cried, and I thought that was beautiful. And there were domestic thrillers, some of them starring little children that were, like, really good actors, actually. There were biopics. There were a couple of these really imaginative dramas. One of them mixed supernatural elements with this really sad story about a little boy and his grandmother. That was very lovely, and people really responded to it. The winner also had an interesting drama where it was kind of about these kids who are playing army, and so we see them as them playing army, but then we also see them as soldiers who alternately, like, speak in war cliches, very fury, or speak like little kids. Like, there's one part where two of them are fighting, and the one kid says to the other, as, like, a big army man, "Nobody likes you, you know that?" And it made me laugh really hard. But it was really thoughtful. And then there were comedies, like the one I mentioned, which was called Action Movie 3, the sequel, which I just thought that was hilarious all through. There was one about a guy getting a vasectomy that won prizes and was very funny. There was one about a guy who had ADD, and there was one about a couple dealing with the man's own insecurities about his body, which was actually really sweet and funny and well done. Just the barrage of things that people came up with was really incredible. And it was my second year there, and I just had an incredible time. And I feel like if you're an aspiring filmmaker, you should definitely look into this, and I would recommend going there and shooting something, because if you become one of those 20 people, you have such an incredible shot at these amazing prizes and at this incredible access, because this festival also breaks down the barriers where, like, we were encouraged to talk to people, and the filmmakers were encouraged to talk to us, and it was really wonderful to find out where they came from on things, and I don't know, it was a great environment. It's just really shocking.
Cool.
I kind of wish I could, like, pack up and go down there just to make a short film and ride the system through and see what happens, because it does sound like a great experience.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually telling a lot of them about Child Eater. We did a panel, Daniel Wahlberg, Katie Cloutier, and I was, like, telling people, like, look up Child Eater, because, like, you did what a lot of people of them want to do now, where they made this short film they're proud of, they feel the story has a greater ability, and now they want to make it features. And I was like, she did production journals? We talked about it on the podcast? I was like, check out Child Eater.
Aww.
That makes me so happy.
Well, I mean, like, you know, you did a great job. But yeah, do you guys have any questions about this, or? Go ahead.
What was your personal favorite?
That's so hard. I really don't know. I actually had to write down what I personally voted for, because I was allowed to pick 5, and then 3 of those were ranked. And that counted for the Founders Prizes and things. I had to write down what I picked, because it was so hard to choose. There were about, like, I honestly, about half the films were so good that I was, like, ripped up picking. It's really hard to say. I'm excited to see a few of them again, and I've been in touch with some of the filmmakers of the ones I really liked, and basically being like, tell me when you do more things, or, like, tell me when this goes online, and it's really exciting. I'm looking forward to when they go online so I can, like, share some of these with you guys, because, like...
Yeah, after you've been saying it, I kind of want to see some of them.
Yeah. It'll be a bit, because some of them are going to be entering festivals and stuff, but yeah, I'll check back if these get online. I'll let people know, because some of them are really, really fun.
So, Louisiana Film Prize, every October, like, the second week in October, so if you want to get in on it, go shoot something in Shreveport now and hurry up.
Yeah, check out their, go to their website, check out what the rules are. And the people down there are just incredible. The team they have that put this festival together, they're just so full of energy and excitement for what they're doing and purpose. And, you know, it makes for a festival that is just outstanding in absolutely every way.
Cool stuff.
And well, don't forget to check out Christy's on-site report from there.
Yes.
Yeah, we had a bonus episode, so you can check that out. And in it, I'm drinking a drive-through daiquiri because that's a thing in Louisiana.
Amazing.
I also ate Gator. Guys, I had such an amazing time. Like, the movies and then just... there was food everywhere.
I bet it was better than the food in the Javits Center.
Probably. I'm going to bet that's true. I was actually watching, like, your feed and being, like, people talking about New York Comic Con, and I was like, oh, my God, it's 80 degrees in Louisiana. I had a rooftop pool. I was like, forget New York.
Rub it in, why don't ya? Well, the only bright side to not going to the Louisiana Film Prize and being in New York was the fact that that Saturday morning I got to see Birdman, which is friggin' awesome. So let's talk about Birdman. The movie stars Michael Keaton as a guy named Riggin, and he is kind of famous now, like waning famous, because he used to be Birdman, the star of a trilogy of superhero movies, so super popular. He hasn't had many big movies since, though, and he's kind of trying to do his own thing and revitalize his career a little bit by adapting a play for Broadway and bringing it back to Broadway. So he's basically on the verge of he's doing rehearsals and on the verge of doing previews. And while they're doing rehearsals, something happens to one of his lead actors, and he needs a new one. And it just so happens that another woman in his show, who's played by Naomi Watts, is dating this guy named Mike Shiner, who's kind of like one of the hottest things on Broadway right now, a guy with a bad attitude who can get fired from jobs, but at the same time do no wrong and bring in tickets. So it's all about their tumultuous relationship as they move the show through rehearsals and previews. And then we've also got Emma Stone, who plays his daughter, and they've got, like, father-daughter issues. There's Zach Galifianakis, who is his best friend, producer, slash lawyer, and he's kind of, like, had it up to here with Michael Keaton's behavior. There's Andrea Riseborough, who plays another woman in the show, who Michael Keaton's got a little bit of a thing going on with. Am I missing anyone?
Amy Ryan.
Amy Ryan plays his ex-wife, who kind of has a foot in the world as well. And it's kind of just about him trying to figure out how to make this show work and where he stands within this industry and what it means to him to be famous and successful. And it is incredible, and it all takes place in one shot. Like, one shot, you know, it's fake. You can, and if you're looking for it, you can see where they probably cut it. But it is so freaking seamless. I cannot believe this. If this movie doesn't get some sort of cinematography nod, it's going to blow my mind. This is one of the most beautiful things I've seen all year. And the movie is just fantastic as well. It is so much fun to watch. These characters are so much fun to track. And, poor Michael Keaton, because it's so obvious that they're blurring the lines between fiction and reality here. But seriously... what a fucking way to make a comeback. This is just incredible work from him. People are already talking about best actor type stuff, and I am totally behind it. This is one of my top 10 movies of the year. I mean, of course, we still have two more months to go, but this is firmly up there. If this comes out of it, I'd be really surprised.
Yeah, the Michael Keaton casting was a lot like the Ben Affleck and Gone Girl thing that we talked about, where, you know, what we know about him in real life just goes such a long way toward making him the perfect guy to play this role. But it doesn't feel like it's just, you know, Michael Keaton playing himself or anything. Like, he's, the character, once, at first I was like, oh, okay, so Michael Keaton's doing, like, a kind of version of his own story, but, you know, once the movie starts, it doesn't feel like that at all. The movie has a lot of weird, like, surrealistic touches. The first time you see Michael Keaton's character, Riggin Thompson, he's levitating, and it has, like, little moments like that throughout. I think that the one-shot thing adds to the dreamlike, surreal quality of it. You just kind of are going, following along in this haze.
You say surreal, and I agree with it, but it's like an odd blend of surreal and natural. It's like, yeah, all the surreal things are so firmly in his head that they don't feel like, I don't know, like some sort of like mystical, magical quality or anything like that.
Yeah, I'm not saying this is like, I don't know, the Congress or anything like that.
Though it kind of is in that the casting, where you have someone playing with, like, your knowledge of them already. I mean, you guys know, and if I haven't talked about it on the podcast, that's on me. But I love Michael Keaton. He is my Batman. He will always be my Batman. And, like, I was so excited for this movie. My anticipation for this movie was so high that, honestly, I was setting myself up for a big disappointment. But it was amazing. So, cheers for everyone. This is just such a fun fucking movie. And, like, technically, it's incredible. I was saying in my review for Cinema Blend that, like, people are going to be looking about how this film was lit and shot for decades. It's really inventful. It's really, exciting. The way they use lighting in particular is just really smart and clever.
I can't even wrap my head around how they made that possible. I just don't understand how you could have a scene well lit and then have the camera make those kinds of moves. It just makes, I just can't figure out how they did it.
Most of the film takes place backstage in this Broadway theater, and it's amazing because it feels like an entire world. Like, it feels so rich, and there's so many places to go and things, and at the same time, it feels incredibly claustrophobic. It fits the movie really well.
And it actually looks like a New York movie, which is something I always appreciate as a New Yorker. Like, there's scenes where he goes out, which you've seen in the trailer, where he goes out in Times Square, and you're just like, this is really Times Square.
You said it to me. You said I was going to love that, and I did. I mean, I had so much fun finding my places, and even when he was, like, I mean, up on a rooftop, it's not a spoiler, we see that in the trailer, but it's like, I knew what he was looking at, and it felt so authentic, too. Like, the way people react when he ran through the Times Square area in his underwear, like, yeah, that's what people would do.
Yeah, and I really love just the capturing of the spirit of being backstage. Like, I have not done theater since high school, but the way everyone behaves, it was such a familiar thing to me, and that kind of excitement about putting on a show, and also the just fucking fear of it all. And because of the way the film is shot, where you're always moving with the characters, like, you feel a part of that rush, and it's so exciting. And also because of the soundtrack, which, like, I'm someone that tends not to notice the soundtrack until, like, the second or third time I've watched a movie, but this one, there's this drum that's just like, ba ba da ba ba ba.
It's the most,
and there's, like,
it's the most jazz drumming you'll hear in a movie this year that's not Whiplash.
Well, it's also, there's, like, no, like,
sensible rhythm. That's what it was making me think of, too. I was picturing Miles Teller being, like...
Well, there's, like, no sensible rhythm to it, so what was exciting, like, it made me excited, but it also made me anxious, because, like, I couldn't, like, rest into the music, which is fitting, because it puts you into this world with Michael Keaton's character, who is risking his reputation and his relationship with his daughter and all of his money on this show that is quickly becoming, like, more and more and more complicated than he expected. And also, Edward Norton is really fun in this, and again, plays with his persona, because I don't know, if you don't follow New York theater, you may not know this. Norton has a reputation for being, let's say, tricky when he's in a show. And so it's kind of wonderful to watch him play an egomaniac and for him to have so much fun with it. And he's great in this. My favorite scenes with him, and there are a lot of good stuff to choose from, but my favorite scenes with him are actually between him and Emma Stone, who is, for once in a while, I don't even think she's ever done this before, gets to play a character who is mean. Like, not like, yeah. Winsome Emma Stone smile. Ding! She, like, she's mean.
Because, I mean, we're talking about...
Is she mean? Because at points I found her really mean and harsh, but then... all of a sudden I would consider what she might have gone through in her childhood.
I don't think she's a bad person.
And I'm like, well, you know, maybe you deserve to be yelling at someone like this.
Well, I don't think she's mean so much as just, she's like a harder and kind of a spikier character than most of the people she's played. I mean, like, so much of her popularity comes from, like, how charming and charismatic and likable she is, and she plays that character a lot, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. I think she's a great actress, but
I like that she got someone who's not sassy in this. Like,
It was exciting to see her break out and play someone who seems really brittle and damaged and fucked up and, like, has some really sharp edges to her, has a nastiness and a hardness to her that most of her characters don't.
And it's earned.
Yes, but speaking of seeing the characters, going back to the camera work for a bit, one of the things I loved about it was the way that, since the camera is always falling around a character, it's usually Michael Keaton's character, but sometimes it's not, and one of the things I loved about that is that when it follows someone else, there are moments in the film when it feels like it's a film about an entirely different person. Like, there's, like, for example, there's a scene where Zach Galifianakis has just had it up to here, and he just says something like, I'm the one that's keeping this whole fucking thing afloat, and the way the camera is, like, following him in that moment, you, for a second, I had a flash of what this movie would look like if the entire thing was built around his character. There's so many little moments like that. Unlike, you know, the other...
That's my one complaint about this movie, though, is that I almost wish that there was, like, another half hour, because I wanted more of him. I wanted more of Naomi Watts. I wanted more of Andrea Riseborough. I wanted more of Amy Ryan. I mean, they're fine. I was very happy with what I got from all them, but I walked out wanting to know, like, Like, what do you do when you're not freaking out at that show? And, like, who are you beyond what we're seeing here?
I kind of wish that we could see the whole movie done again, but all from Zach Galifianakis' perspective. He was one of my favorite supporting characters because he seems like he's kind of the one that has to be mean because it's his
that
job to be mean.
That's a really interesting idea.
It's also a different role for him, which is exciting. Like, it's like, one, he's lost some weight for this role, and two, it's not him being like, I'm Crazy Alan from The Hangover, which, like, I know he can do more things, because I've seen his stand-up and stuff, but in this, he actually got to do something different, and, like, play
this. He's almost unrecognizable in this.
Yeah, it's great.
Between the weight loss and the way the character behaves, you would never guess it was him.
Yeah.
This is going to get, like ensemble nominations and stuff like that.
Oh, and it should.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm really excited to see, like, for me, this is a heavy hitter going into Oscar season, and I kind of loathe talking about the Oscars already, but, like, it's just this movie, like, I'm with Perry. This is near the top of my list, if not at the top of my list. It was so much fun, and it does so many things. Like we said, it does all this technical stuff. It has the rare father-daughter movie, which, like, there's another goddamn father-son movie every weekend. Fury. Whiplash, where they may not literally be that, but that's the dynamic. And then, like, you have this one that it's actually about them, and while those are, like, a pocket of the film, it doesn't feel underdeveloped. And then you have this just sort of forced performance from Michael Keaton. There's so much going on, and none of it felt cheated to me. And, like, I'm with Perry, where I would happily have watched this for another half an hour, but, like, I was just...
I would have happily sat through this a couple more times.
Yeah, as soon as it ended, I was like, I want to watch it again right now. If I just wanted to go back into that world, and because of the way, you know, because of all the things they were talking about the way it was shot and the way it's lit and the way it's set up, it really just feels like you are in this world, and I wanted to go back in there.
The only thing that made me okay with it being over is because I went to the New York Film Festival screening, and the cast was all there to talk after. I mean, it was some really bad questions. I can't say I got very much good information out of it, but it was still really entertaining. And
I was jealous of that. I was following. I was in Louisiana, like, checking my Twitter feed, and people just being like, "This is what they're saying," and I was like,
"I can't remember this entirely, but I swear to God, someone like I don't want to spoil anything. Someone like mentioned Naomi Watts' nose. Like, some reporter like could not formulate the question properly, and I'm not going to spoil anything. But, like, do you know what I'm saying?
I have no idea what you're saying. Actually,
I don't either. I'll have to explain it after.
But I want to ask you guys about one scene in the movie. So as people who write about movies for a living, you can guess where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
So one of the characters in the movie is a theater critic who works for the New York Times, and, like, in the context of this movie, she's a woman whose good word can...
Lindsay Duncan, notably.
Yes. She's the critic. She's the make-or-break critic. If she likes your play, it's going to, you know, run forever and make a gazillion dollars, and if you don't, you guys are probably going to close, like, the next day or something. And there's a scene where she's just railing about how much she hates it when movie stars come into theater and just think they can just fucking take over. She hates it. She, like, you know, goes... She and Michael Keaton have a heated confrontation where she basically threatens to destroy him, and, you know, as
promises.
What?
She promises.
She does.
She's like, I'm going to destroy you.
You're right. It's not a threat, because it's not like, if you do this, I won't. It's just like, no, I'm going to destroy you. So, I don't know. As someone who reviews things for a living, what did you guys think of that whole thing?
I mean, I liked it. I don't personally write stuff with that. One, I don't believe I have any kind of power comparable to the one in the critic in the movie is presented with. Like,
I'm pretty sure not even the real New York Times theater critic has that kind of power.
But I mean, like, I liked it within the context of the movie, where everything is depending on this moment, and no matter, and, like, he's confronted with this thing of, like, no matter how hard he tries, this woman that he needs to convince this is going to be incredible is going to say no. And it's like, I don't think it's a, you know, quote-unquote fair depiction of critics, but I mean, like, you know, everybody in this movie, like, their actors are made to look like assholes in this movie, producers are made to look like maniac liars in this movie. Like, it's a movie where everybody associated with show business gets, like, a very satirical, very critical element, so I was by no means, like, offended or anything, and I actually think that she spoke to something that does exist, where there's a certain stigma when big stars come to Broadway. And so I feel like they took that and they blew it up into something big. But I thought Lindsay Duncan was really fun in that role. I liked her, like, scathing over... Though there's one thing that he says that I thought was unfair and the movie doesn't really address. He says to her, basically, what does it take to be a critic? You risk nothing. And I was like, oh, that's not true. Like, I understand people who spent all their time on things and then feel like we just come in and are like, this was terrible, and we tear it apart. But no, we, and I'm not going to say it's on the same level or anything, but we do risk something because we put our names on what we're saying. And so people do get mad at us for things that are our opinion.
After a string of not so nice comments, I definitely, that line caught me, and I'm like, well, I don't know if that's entirely accurate.
Notably.
Yeah.
Yeah,
when I heard that line, maybe it's just because I don't care as much when people yell at me online, but when I heard that, I was like, no, that's actually kind of an interesting point. You're right. You know, a lot of times the people I'm criticizing are risking more things than I am in some ways.
Well, but it is true. I mean, having just made child ear, you do risk a lot, you know? Like, you put months of your life into something, you swipe your credit cards and all that, and then all of a sudden, there's, like, sometimes a 400-word review that could just be like, this is shit, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, that's the tricky thing. I do think that this film, like Chef, ultimately comes around to the idea of what we all want, whether we're a creator or a critic, is good art. We want something that excites us, and I think the film does an interesting job of handling that, though not in such a warm and fuzzy way as Chef, so don't expect that.
It's been a good year for movie about creative pursuits, like between this and like with
you know what's funny is I...
And the
film festival movie I had seen right before this one was Clouds of Sils Maria, which is kind of essentially about the same thing, about like blurring the line between fiction and reality and exploring what it means to be an actor and like how to achieve what you want to achieve on the stage or on the screen for that matter, and if it's okay to push yourself to a certain extreme.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very similar topic, but explored in two entirely different ways. And they both still felt really fresh. Well, so what's the verdict on Birdman? Do I even have to ask?
Birdman!
Go see it now.
What's wrong with you? Where aren't you seeing it already?
Birdman is limited this week, and then it doesn't open wide until December?
Fine, I guess that's a good
one. Is that how this works?
Is that true? Oh my god, that makes me so sad for everyone that's not me.
I'm pretty sure that's how it works. Because I didn't even think today was, like, a thing. For some reason, I thought it was going to be December.
No, I think it's in limited release today. I don't know when it's in wide release off the top of my head. But Christy, don't be so sad. Think about it this way. The people who haven't seen it yet now have the opportunity to watch Birdman for the first time, which is an experience you will never have again.
Yeah, but like, put it on your calendar. Make that happen. I'm like genuinely sad for people. I thought everybody could rush out this weekend and have an amazing time with Birdman. I'm still kind of catching up from being away for 4 days and being, my brain is kind of stewing in all the fried foods I ate. And so
yeah, that sounds like how biology works.
Stop complaining. You and your dry food.
I'm not complaining. I'm just explaining that I think that's why I had an oversight about this. But yeah, everyone.
You guys, I think Christy may have had a couple of drive-through daiquiris before coming on today.
I filled my suitcase with them and brought them all home.
You didn't bring one home for us? How dare you?
But anyway.
All right, so we are clearly very much recommending Birdman. Go see it.
Also drive-through daiquiris.
That as well. And with that, we are out of time for this week, but thank you guys so much for watching. In between episodes, you can catch us all over the place. You can find us on YouTube. Our channel is Popcorn Prosecco. Watch us on iTunes and listen to us on iTunes. And also don't forget to comment and rate and review. Say lots of positive stuff because we love that. And then we have our website, popcornprosecco.com, and you can also follow us on Twitter, @popcornprosecco, and then all three of us are all over the web as well. Christy, you want to take it first?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, @ChristyPuchko, and you can find my career highlights at decadentcriminals.com, because I'm writing all over the place.
Angie?
You can find me on Twitter, @AJHAN, and I write for slashfilm.com.
And you can catch me @PNemiroff on Twitter, and I'm over at collider.com. So thank you guys so much for watching this week, and we'll see you next time.
Toodles.
Otherwise, a toodles.
This place is horrible. Smells like balls.